Imagine a company that lends out money at an eye-watering 147% interest.
Right, which is just staggering on its face.
Yeah, it really is. And they fully expect up to 16% of their consumer customers to completely default on those loans. Just poof, money gone.
Exactly. Total write-offs.
And furthermore, the executives running this company have been quietly dumping nearly $100 million of their own stock.
Which is usually a massive, glaring red flag.
Right. If you hear those facts in isolation, you might assume this company is, spiraling toward bankruptcy. But instead, Wall Street has aggressively bid this company's stock up 900% from its recent lows.
Yeah, pushing it to an absolute all-time high.
It's wild. So for this deep dive, we are stepping into the incredibly high stakes, deeply complex world of non-prime consumer and small business lending.
It is one of the most fascinating disconnects in modern finance right now.
Absolutely. We are focusing our lens entirely on one company today. It's called Enova International, and they trade on the New York Stock Exchange under the ticker ENVA.
And to guide us through this, we're relying on a really fantastic, highly detailed independent equity research report.
Yeah, we are. It comes from Factors Today, authored by an analyst named Kimi, and it's dated July 19th, 2026.
What makes this specific report so valuable is that it refuses to just swallow the company's press releases.
Thank goodness for that.
Right. It forces you to look at the mechanical engine of the business. It strips away all the marketing fluff and looks at the underlying accounting, the regulatory risks, and the raw unit economics.
Which brings us to our mission for you, the listener, today. Whether you are trying to understand the hidden mechanics of fair value accounting, or you're looking for a masterclass in corporate survival, or maybe you just want to sit back and watch a high wire financial act, we are going to break all of this down for you.
Without the impenetrable Wall Street jargon, hopefully.
Exactly. We want to help you understand how the subprime lender pulled off a massive strategic shift, why they're desperately trying to buy a bank, and ultimately whether this company is a perpetual compounding machine or just, a massive bubble waiting to pop.
Let's start with the narrative, because you really cannot understand Enova without understanding how wildly the market's perception of them has swung over the last few years.
Okay, let's unpack this. If we trace the stock's journey, it is a completely wild 5-year round trip.
We have to go back to the summer of 2022 to really get the context.
Right, because the macro environment was a nightmare. The Federal Reserve was in the middle of a massive interest rate shock, inflation was running super hot, and the market was absolutely terrified of consumer credit defaults.
Everyone thought a massive recession was imminent. And during that panic, in June of 2022, Enova stock hit a trough. It crashed down to $26.63. Yeah. But that price made complete sense under the prevailing narrative at the time. In 2022, Wall Street had a very specific, rigid label for Enova. They categorized them as a high beta non-prime lender.
Okay, let's pause and define that for a second, because high beta is one of those finance terms that gets thrown around a lot. Beta is basically a measure of volatility compared to the broader market, right?
Precisely.
So if the market goes down a little, a high beta stock goes down a lot.
Right. If the S&P 500 drops 1%, a high beta stock might drop 3%. It is inherently sensitive to panic.
And then you add the phrase non-prime lender to that.
And you have a recipe for a massive valuation discount. I mean, investors are incredibly hesitant to pay a premium for a company whose core demographic might stop paying their bills the second a recession hits or, gas prices spike.
Because they have lower credit scores to begin with.
Exactly. You are buying a highly sensitive asset attached to a very vulnerable customer base. So at $26, the market was basically pricing in disaster.
Okay, but fast forward to July 1st, 2026, which is just a couple of weeks before this research report was published.
The turnaround is unbelievable.
It really is. The stock hits an all-time closing high of $242.18. It went from $26 to $242. That is a nine-bagger.
The recent momentum is almost hard to comprehend. The stock is up 102% in just the last 12 months alone.
Wow.
And it is sitting roughly 45% above its 200-day moving average.
Being 45% above a 200-day moving average, I mean, that's technical evidence of a mania, right?
It absolutely is. The 200-day moving average is your baseline trend. When you detach from it by that much, you are essentially in orbit.
But here is the most crucial piece of data from the report's factor analysis. This was not a macroeconomic rising tide lifting all boats.
No, not at all. The report points out that the broader environment was actually hostile to a company like this.
Right. Over the past year, the broader financial sector, the fintech space, and the small cap size factors were all headwinds. The environment was pushing against Enova.
Yet Enova's stock doubled anyway. The market's repricing here is completely idiosyncratic. It is specifically intensely focused on this one company.
So why? What changed their minds?
Well, the market tore up the old label. They are no longer viewing Enova as a risky, high-beta consumer lender. The narrative has completely shifted. Wall Street now views Enova as a, quote, bank charter in waiting compounder.
A bank charter in waiting compounder.
Yes. They believe Enova is on the verge of transforming its entire fundamental structure, acquiring cheap funding, and churning out predictable compounding earnings for the next decade.
And investors will pay a massive premium for a predictable compounder.
Always.
It's kind of like a gritty reality TV star suddenly being treated like Hollywood royalty because, you know, they're rumored to be cast in a prestige Oscar drama.
That's a great analogy. Everyone starts treating them like blue chip royalty before the ink on the contract is even dry.
But is this price run based on fundamental reality, or is it just Wall Street hopium pricing in perfection?
To figure that out, we have to look past the stock chart and open up the hood of the actual business.
Right. What is Enova doing day to day to justify a $5 billion portfolio?
To understand the engine, you have to understand the chassis it sits on. Enova is a 100% online lender.
Okay.
They have 21 years of operating history, but they have zero physical branches.
Which is a huge contrast to how subprime lending usually works. I mean, if you look at their competitor OneMain, they operate something like 1,300 physical storefronts across the country.
Exactly.
Why does OneMain pay for all that real estate, and how does Enova get away without it?
Well, physical storefronts serve two purposes in non-prime lending. First, customer acquisition. The glowing sign in the strip mall attracts walk-in traffic.
Right, visibility.
And second, and more importantly, it builds a localized relationship, which historically helps with collections.
But
it is just fundamentally harder for a borrower to default when they have to look the branch manager in the eye.
That makes sense. Guilt is a powerful collection tool.
It really is. But Enova abandoned that physical model entirely. Instead, they rely purely on digital acquisition and massive computational power.
And the scale of that is crazy. Over 21 years, they have amassed 95 terabytes of behavioral data from over 69 million customer transactions.
Which is a staggering competitive advantage in the digital space.
I want to drill into that behavioral data concept for you, the listener, because 95 terabytes is a mind-boggling amount of information. When we think of lending, we usually think of a FICO credit score, your income, and maybe your debt-to-income ratio.
Right, which is just a few kilobytes of data at most.
Exactly. What exactly is behavioral data, and how does it help them underwrite a loan without ever meeting the person?
Behavioral data looks at how you interact with the digital application itself, not just the financial numbers you input. When you go to CashNet USA or NetCredit, which are Enova's consumer brands, their algorithms are tracking absolutely everything.
Really quiet.
Like, how fast are you typing? Are you copying and pasting your income information, or are you typing it out manually?
Oh, wow. They track copy-pasting.
Yes. Do you read the terms and conditions, or do you scroll past them in 0.2 seconds? What time of day are you applying? What type of device are you using?
Okay, so if I'm applying for a loan at 3:00 a.m. on Tuesday, and I'm frantically copy-pasting numbers from another tab, their algorithm flags that differently than someone applying at 6:00 p.m. on a Sunday who takes 10 minutes to carefully read the fine print.
Exactly. They have 69 million previous transactions to correlate those specific physical behaviors with eventual loan defaults.
That's incredibly invasive, but also fascinating.
It is. They essentially built a digital profile of risk that goes far beyond a traditional credit bureau score. And frankly, they needed to build that because their legacy business, the consumer loan division, is incredibly risky.
Let's talk about that consumer business, because the yields they are pulling in are astronomical. They are charging annualized yields of 90% to 147%.
Which is just a massive number.
Right. If you are a traditional bank investor used to seeing, you know, 5 or 6% yields on a mortgage, seeing 147% looks like a misprint.
It does. But obviously there is a massive catch.
Always a catch.
The catch is the attrition rate. To earn that 147%, Enova has to stomach net charge-offs, meaning loans that completely default and are written off as total losses at a rate of 14 to 16%.
Wait, let me see if I have this straight. For every 100 consumer loans they write, they fully expect up to 16 of them to go up in smoke.
Yes. they will never see that principal again.
So the only way the math works is by charging the surviving 84 people an exorbitant interest rate to cover the losses of the 16 who defaulted, plus the cost of marketing, plus their own borrowing costs.
That is the exact mathematical reality of subprime consumer lending. It is a high chaos, high turnover model. You are constantly fighting gravity.
And I imagine it attracts a lot of regulatory heat.
A massive amount. Consumer protection agencies despise triple-digit interest rates, predictably. Which is why the single most important thing Innova has done in the last 5 years, the move that catalyzed this whole 9x stock run, was pivoting away from being heavily reliant on that consumer model.
Right. The report calls this the SMB pivot. They shifted focus to small and medium-sized business loans.
Under brands like OnDeck and Headway.
And the economics here are completely different, right?
Night and day. The yields on the small business side are much lower, around 48 to 49%.
Still high, but compared to 147%, it's tame.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But look at the default rate. It plummets down to roughly 4.6%.
4.6. That is a massive drop from 16%.
This was a masterstroke of corporate strategy. Innova looked at their portfolio and realized that the consumer business was just too volatile. In the fourth quarter of 2021, small business loans made up 52% of Innova's portfolio. Today, that SMB segment is 70% of a massive $5.3 billion book.
And we really have to talk about how they accelerated this pivot, because it wasn't just, you know, organic word of mouth growth. They pulled off what looks like one of the greatest heists in recent financial history.
It was brilliantly timed.
Yeah, in late 2020, right in the teeth of the pandemic, when small businesses were terrified and credit markets were completely frozen, Innova acquired a competing small business lender called OnDeck.
It was a profoundly well-timed, distressed acquisition. They bought OnDeck for roughly $122 million.
Which is practically nothing in corporate terms.
Right. They paid essentially 1x book value for a company that possessed crucial small business underwriting algorithms and market share. That $122 million acquisition is now the foundational engine powering a $5 billion portfolio.
That is incredible ROI. But I am stuck on this one part, though. Even at a 48% yield on the small business side, that is still a very expensive loan for a small business to take out.
It is.
If a local plumbing company or a restaurant needs capital, why are they paying Innova 48% instead of going to their local community bank and getting a loan for, I don't know, 8%?
Two words. Speed and access. A traditional bank might take 4 weeks to underwrite a small business loan. They require years of tax returns, personal guarantees, and hard collateral.
Right, which takes forever to compile.
Small businesses often experience sudden, acute cash flow crises. Maybe a piece of heavy machinery breaks, or they need to buy inventory for a massive, unexpected order, and they need the cash on Tuesday.
They can't wait a month.
Exactly. Innova's algorithms can approve and fund that loan in hours. The borrower isn't looking at the 48% annualized rate. They're looking at the absolute dollar cost of the interest over a few months versus the cost of missing out on a huge contract or, worst case, closing their doors.
That makes a lot of sense, which brings up a critical structural advantage of this SMB book duration.
Yes.
The report notes that these small business loans turn over in about 15 months. They are incredibly short duration assets. Why is that such a superpower for Innova?
In lending, duration is risk. Think about it like this. If you issue a 30-year fixed mortgage at 3%, and then inflation spikes and your own cost of borrowing goes to 5%, you are trapped.
Right, because you can't change the rate on the borrower.
Exactly. You lose money on that mortgage for the next 3 decades. But Innova's small business loans pay down completely in 15 months. That means the cash is constantly flowing back into Innova's hands.
So they can adjust constantly.
Yes. If the macroeconomic environment gets riskier, they can instantly tighten their underwriting standards for new loans. If their own borrowing costs go up, they can instantly raise the interest rates on the new loans they issue next week.
It's fast money. They are never locked into a bad macroeconomic hand for more than a few quarters.
And because that default rate is anchored so low, the report says it's held steady around that 4.6% mark for 9 straight quarters, the profit margins are spectacular.
We're talking 69 to 71% net revenue margins on the SMB side. They basically traded the absolute chaos of 147% consumer rates for clean, reliable, fast-turning small business credit.
And the results speak for themselves. The report calculates a 24% return on equity and a 5.3% return on assets.
Okay, let's break down return on equity, or ROE, for the listener, because 24% is a massive number. Like, if I open a lemonade stand and I put $100 of my own money into it...
That $100 is your equity.
Right, that's my equity. And at the end of the year, I make $24 in pure profit. My ROE is 24%.
Which is incredible.
Because in the banking sector, a typical, well-run, traditional bank might target an ROE of, what, 10 to 12%?
Exactly. Enova's doubling that.
Doubling it.
And in traditional financial theory, if a company is generating a 24% return on equity year after year, it implies they have a massive, impenetrable structural moat.
Right. They must have some sort of competitive advantage that stops rivals from coming in and stealing all those profits.
But here is where the research report violently tears that textbook theory apart. It applies the Greenwald taxonomy to assess competitive advantage. And it concludes that Enova has absolutely no traditional moat.
None.
None. Let's start with the demand side. Do they have captive customers? Are there switching costs keeping a borrower locked into the Enova ecosystem?
Let me guess. The answer is a resounding zero.
A total zero. There is no customer captivity whatsoever. When a small business needs capital, cash is perfectly fungible.
$100,000 from Enova spends exactly the same as $100,000 from a competitor.
Precisely. There is no software ecosystem locking the borrower in. A business owner can sit at their computer and apply to 10 different online lenders in 20 minutes and simply take whichever one approves them fastest.
And the proof that there is no customer loyalty is sitting right there on Enova's income statement.
It's glaring.
In 2025, Enova spent 19.7% of its total revenue just on marketing. And by the first quarter of 2026, that had risen to 22%.
It's like they're running on a giant treadmill.
Yeah, that treadmill analogy is perfect. The moment they stop spending a fifth of their revenue on Google Ads and direct mail, the business simply stops. They don't own the track. They are just forced to run faster than everyone else on it.
Exactly. A business with a true captive monopoly. Like, think of an enterprise software company where the cost of switching providers would paralyze a client's operations. They don't need to spend 22 cents of every dollar they make just to find their next transaction.
Enova has to basically buy its revenue every single quarter.
Yes, they do.
So if they don't have a demand side moat, what about the supply side? Do they have a structural advantage in how they get the money they lend out?
No. In fact, this is their most glaring structural weakness. Enova relies almost entirely on wholesale funding.
Walk us through what wholesale funding actually means in this context, because this is the crucial difference between a company like Enova and a traditional bank like JPMorgan Chase.
Well, a traditional bank funds its loans using customer deposits. When you deposit your paycheck into a checking account, the bank might pay you 0% or maybe 1% interest.
Right. They take your practically free money and lend it out for auto loans or mortgages at 6 or 7%. That spread is their profit.
Enova doesn't have depositors. To get the $5 billion they lend out, they have to go to the capital markets. They use things like corporate debt and securitization shelves.
Meaning they bundle up thousands of these small business and consumer loans, package them together, and sell bonds backed by the payments on those loans to institutional investors.
Exactly. And institutional investors demand a real return, especially when they are taking on subprime risk. According to the report, in the first quarter of 2026, Enova's average cost of funds was 8.2%.
Wow. So they are starting from a massive structural disadvantage. They are paying 8.2% for their raw material, the cash, while a traditional bank might be paying 1 or 2%.
Precisely. They do not have a cost advantage.
That actually explains a lot, because if your money costs you over 8%, you have no choice but to charge your borrowers 48% or 90% just to cover your marketing costs, your expected defaults, and still, you know, scrape out a profit margin.
Right. The math forces their hand.
So I am struggling to understand this. If they have no captive customers, they have to spend 22% of revenue on marketing, and their cost of capital is an expensive 8.2%. How did they survive the brutal capital cycle we just went through between 2024 and 2026?
It's a great question, because a lot of people didn't survive.
The report explicitly notes that their competitors got absolutely crushed during this period. A rival storefront lender named CURO went completely bankrupt in March of 2024. Another competitor, Opportune, was bleeding tens of millions of dollars, yet Enova thrived and hit a 24% ROE. What is their actual advantage?
The analyst, Kimi, defines their advantage perfectly. It's, quote, economies of scale plus learned underwriting data inside a regulatory maze. It is an execution edge. It is not a structural castle moat. It is a process moat.
Meaning they don't have a magical shield. They have just stepped on all the regulatory landmines already, so they know exactly where to walk.
That's a great way to put it.
Let's break down that regulatory maze, because operating across state lines in subprime lending sounds like an absolute nightmare.
It is a total labyrinth. Mm-hmm. Enova operates in 37 to 39 different states for consumer lending and 49 states for small businesses. Every single state in the U.S. has its own Department of Financial Institutions.
Right.
They have their own usury caps, which are the maximum interest rates you are legally allowed to charge, and their own specific disclosure requirements. And those laws change constantly. A state legislature might suddenly pass a bill capping consumer rates at 36%.
Which would instantly make Enova's 147% loan illegal in that state.
Exactly. And when those state laws change, companies with massive physical footprints and rigid legacy systems, like CURO, simply couldn't adapt fast enough. Their localized unit economics collapsed.
But Enova's centralized technology stack allows them to react instantly.
Yes. If a state changes its rate cap on a Friday, Enova's engineers and compliance teams can rewrite the underwriting algorithms and roll out a newly compliant loan product by Monday morning.
That's insane agility.
They literally out-execute the competition quarter by quarter. The bankruptcies of their peers weren't accidents. They were the result of slower companies suffocating in that same regulatory maze while Enova just sprinted through it.
But running on a treadmill at a sprint is exhausting, and eventually even the fastest runner gets tired. Which brings us to the most pivotal section of this entire deep dive. Because Enova is painfully aware of their 8.2% cost of capital, they are making a massive, company-defining gamble to fundamentally change their structure.
This is the ultimate swing factor for the entire stock price. Everything we've discussed so far is basically prelude to this single strategic move.
In December of 2025, Enova announced a definitive agreement to acquire Grasshopper Bancorp for roughly $369 million. Now, Grasshopper is a digital national bank. It has $1.4 billion in assets, and crucially, it has about $3 billion in customer deposits.
And those deposits are the holy grail.
Yeah.
If you are a non-bank lender relying on expensive securitization shelves, acquiring a bank with $3 billion in cheap deposits is like discovering an oasis in the desert.
But they can't just write a check and take the bank, right?
Yeah.
This deal requires intense regulatory approval from the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and the Federal Reserve.
And it is not a slam dunk.
Not at all, because Enova is facing organized, highly vocal opposition. The report impartially details that prominent advocacy groups like the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, the Center for Responsible Lending, and the National Consumer Law Center have all formally urged federal regulators to block or deny the merger.
And it is important we look at this debate objectively, purely from a risk assessment standpoint for the listener.
Right.
The advocacy groups are highly critical of Enova's fundamental business model. They point to those 100%+ yields on the consumer side, and they argue that allowing Enova to acquire a national bank charter would essentially create a federally sanctioned vehicle for what they categorize as predatory lending.
They want to prevent high-cost lenders from gaining the legitimacy and the funding advantages of the federal banking system.
Exactly. They also heavily cite Enova's past regulatory history, pointing to prior consent orders from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB.
Right. But to present the complete factual picture detailed in the research report, we have to note that Enova operates strictly within the legal bounds of state rate caps wherever it does business. If a state allows 147% rate, they charge it. If the state caps it at 36%, they comply.
They follow the local laws.
And regarding that regulatory history, the report specifically notes that the most recent 2023 CFPB consent order was terminated in full by the agency, effective in August of 2025, with alleged noncompliance waived.
So the company approaches this merger application arguing that their regulatory slate is clean.
Right. And they argue they provide vital access to credit for subprime consumers and small businesses that traditional risk-averse banks have completely abandoned.
And listen, we aren't here to adjudicate the morality of the interest rates. Our job is to analyze whether this $369 million deal will actually close. Mm. Because the advocacy groups have real influence in Washington, and they are making a coordinated push to at least delay the approval, if not kill it entirely.
And there is another layer of regulatory risk here that makes this bank charter acquisition so desperate. It is called the true lender risk, specifically referencing the cash call legal doctrine.
This is a huge piece of the puzzle.
The report notes that 31.6% of Enova's current loan originations run through third-party partner banks. Walk me through the mechanics of this, because this sounds like a massive legal vulnerability. What is a true lender risk?
This is one of the most fascinating and contentious battlegrounds in fintech law. It's often referred to as the rent-a-bank model. Here's how it works. Enova, a non-bank, wants to lend money to a consumer in a state with strict usury caps.
Like New York, for example.
Sure, New York. But federal law allows state-chartered banks to export the interest rates of their home state across state lines.
Okay, hold on. Let me make sure I have this. If a small bank is based in Utah, and Utah has no maximum interest rate limit, that Utah bank can legally issue a loan at 100% interest to a borrower living in New York, even though New York has strict laws capping interest rates at, say, 25%.
Exactly. The federal banking rules override the New York state laws.
Wow. Okay.
So a non-bank lender like Enova will partner with one of these small state-chartered banks. The bank actually originates the loan, legally exporting that high interest rate. Then, a few days later, the bank turns around and sells the majority of that loan back to Enova, who services it and collects the profits.
And the small bank just takes a fee?
Right. They take a small fee for essentially renting out their charter.
That sounds like a brilliant loophole, but I'm guessing regulators don't see it that way.
They absolutely do not. The true lender doctrine, which is built heavily on legal precedents like the cash call case, is a legal argument that pierces through that structure. Regulators in courts look at the arrangement and say, wait a minute, Enova is doing all the marketing, Enova built the underwriting algorithm, Enova buys the loan 3 days later, and Enova takes 90% of the financial risk. The small bank is just a rubber stamp.
So the doctrine argues that whoever holds the predominant economic interest is the true lender. And if a court decides that Enova is the true lender, not the Utah bank, then that federal preemption vanishes. Enova is suddenly subject to the New York State usury cap of 25%.
Which means the 100% interest loan they issued is suddenly illegal, potentially void, and entirely unenforceable.
They could lose the entire principal.
With 31.6% of their originations running through these partnerships, the true lender risk is an existential sword of Damocles hanging over a massive chunk of their revenue.
Wow. So acquiring Grasshopper Bank isn't just an offensive play to get cheaper deposit funding. It is a massive defensive maneuver. If they own the national bank charter themselves, they eliminate that third-party partner risk entirely. They become the bank.
Precisely. If this Grasshopper deal is approved cleanly by the OCC and the Fed, it fundamentally rewires the company's DNA. It takes that expensive 8.2% wholesale debt and replaces a huge chunk of it with cheap retail deposits.
It instantly creates the first true structural cost moat in the company's entire 21-year history.
Yes, and management claims this transformation could add more than 25% in adjusted earnings per share once full synergies are realized.
So what does this all mean? A 25% earnings boost just from swapping out how they borrow money. That completely explains why the stock went from 26 to 255 a head. The market is pricing in that 25% boost as if it is a guaranteed certainty.
But the research report clearly points out that Enova's own 10K SEC filings admit the current stock price already assumes this deal is going to close.
That is the danger of investing at all-time highs. All the good news is already in the price. So what happens if the regulators side with the advocacy groups? What happens if the Fed says no, or if they impose conditions that gut the economics, or they just drag the approval process out into 2027?
If the deal fails, the premium that has been baked into the stock price over the last year likely evaporates overnight. The report's scenario analysis suggests that without the Grasshopper charter, the standalone Enova business is still profitable, but it reverts back to being valued as a high beta lender without a moat.
That implies catastrophic downside risk from the current price of $232.
Exactly. It's a massive cliff.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's pretend for a second that the Grasshopper deal does close perfectly. The regulatory hurdles vanish. We still need to look at Enova's current financial reality, because the report argues that Enova's financials might look vastly better on paper than they do in actual reality, all due to a very specific, highly technical accounting choice.
This is where Kimi's report earns its weight in gold. It digs past the headline earnings and gets into the mechanics of their fair value accounting election.
Let's break this down slowly for everyone, because accounting rules can get dense, but the implications here are terrifying. In 2020, Enova made an accounting election known as ASU 2019-05. They decided to use fair value accounting for their entire loan portfolio.
Right.
Because of this specific choice, something major is completely missing from their balance sheet. Most traditional lenders have a CECL allowance. That stands for Current Expected Credit Losses. What is a CECL allowance, and why doesn't Enova have one?
In traditional banking, when you issue a loan, you know that some percentage of borrowers won't pay you back. Under CECL rules, the bank has to estimate those future losses on day one and set aside a massive pile of money, an allowance, to cover them.
And this hits their earnings immediately.
Yes, it is a conservative way to account for risk. Enova, however, opted out of that system. Because they elected fair value accounting, they don't hold a separate allowance for bad loans.
Okay, wait, so they just completely bypass the standard allowance rules? So how do they account for the 16% of consumers who are going to default?
The credit costs flow directly through a single line item called change in fair value. They value the entire portfolio of loans as a single living, breathing asset that goes up or down in value every quarter based on their internal models.
And the number that jumps off the balance sheet is staggering. The loans are carried at what is called a level three mark-to-model value. And currently, Enova is carrying a $774 million premium of fair value over the actual principal of the loans they issued.
It's a massive markup.
Let me repeat that. They have marked up the value of their loans by $774 million above the actual cash they lent out. That premium equals roughly 58% of their entire total equity.
To understand why this is a potential mirage, we have to deeply understand what a level three asset is. In accounting, there is a hierarchy of a liability. Level one assets are things with easily observable, instantaneous public market prices.
Think of shares of Apple stock. You know exactly what a share of Apple is worth at 1:04 p.m. on a Tuesday because millions of people are trading it. It is indisputable cash value.
Exactly. Level two assets are a bit murkier, right? There isn't a perfect public exchange, but you can price them based on easily observable inputs.
Like valuing a used 2019 Honda Civic. There isn't a stock ticker for it, but you can look at the Kelley Blue Book and recent dealer sales and get a highly accurate estimate.
Right. But level three assets are the wild west of accounting. There are no observable market prices. You can't look it up. The value is determined entirely by the company's internal proprietary mathematical models.
So Enova is modeling out the future cash flows of these subprime loans, assuming a certain low default rate, applying a specific discount rate, and deciding internally that their portfolio is worth $774 million more than the actual cash they handed to borrowers.
It's like they're grading their own homework, giving themselves an A-plus, and refusing to show us the rubric.
That is exactly what it feels like.
That is the inherent risk of level three accounting.
Yeah.
And the report highlights a very dangerous dynamic called the mark-to-model trap. When Enova is growing its loan book rapidly, this accounting method mechanically flatters their earnings.
How so?
When they issue a new batch of loans, those loans enter the balance sheet near par value. But in subsequent quarters, the internal model marks those loans up in value, anticipating the high interest payments coming in.
And the report gives a specific, shocking example of how wild this gets in practice. In the first quarter of 2026, on the consumer side of the business, Enova had $227.6 million in realized cash losses, actual defaults, real money gone forever.
Right.
But the fair value marks, the internal model adjustments pulling future expected profits forward, actually offset those losses to the tune of $215.5 million. So their profit and loss statement barely felt the sting of $250 million in bad loans, because the model said the surviving loans became mathematically more valuable.
The mechanics of it are deeply concerning if the growth ever stops. As long as they're growing originations, the new loans provide a constant rushing stream of upward mark adjustments that paper over the actual realized cash losses bleeding out from the older loans.
But if loan growth stalls, or if the macroeconomic environment turns sour and they are forced to revise their internal default assumptions upward, this mechanism runs in brutal reverse.
It does. That $774 million premium is not hard cash sitting in a vault. It is a mathematical assumption.
And the most terrifying part of this entire accounting section, the report notes that Enova flat out refuses to disclose its loss assumption sensitivity. Most companies will provide a stress test in their filings. They will say, if interest rates move by 1%, our portfolio loses X amount of value.
It's standard practice.
But Enova does not disclose what would happen to their balance sheet if their internal default models are off by, say, 10%. If unemployment ticks up to 6% and subprime default spike, could that entire $774 million premium just vanish into thin air?
Yes, absolutely. If the internal models are forced to recognize higher expected future losses, that premium compresses incredibly rapidly. And it doesn't just disappear quietly, it hits the income statement as a massive, catastrophic write-down, instantly wiping out quarters of perceived profit.
Wow.
Now, the report does objectively acknowledge that for the last 2 years, Inova's models have been accurate. The marks have been stable and corroborated by realized cash flows. Management has not been reckless with the models recently.
Okay, that's fair.
But going into a potential turning point in the credit cycle, without knowing how sensitive that 58% of their equity is to higher defaults, that requires a massive leap of faith for an investor buying the stock at an all-time high.
Which perfectly transitions us to the next massive red flag. If we have hidden, complex accounting risks tied up in Level 3 models, and we have massive regulatory hurdles surrounding the bank charter, we should probably look at what the people who are actually running the company are doing with their own personal money.
Because the people who build those Level 3 models know better than anyone how fragile they are.
Exactly. And the divergence here between what the company says and what the executives are doing is absolutely staggering.
It is arguably the starkest contrast presented in the entire research report.
Let's start with the official corporate narrative. Inova, the corporation, has been a massive buyer of its own stock. Since 2019, they have repurchased $1.0 billion of their own shares.
Which is a huge amount of capital.
Through those buybacks, they have cut the total outstanding share count by an incredible 31%. And they just announced a brand new $400 million buyback authorization. If you look at the press releases, the corporate entity is screaming to the market, "Our stock is a bargain, we believe in the future, and we are buying it hand over fist."
That is the message to the public. But then you look at the insider tape, the actual human beings running the company, the executives, and the board of directors.
The numbers are genuinely shocking. Over a 24-month period leading up to this report, looking at 133 individual SEC ownership filings, there was exactly one open market purchase by an insider. A single director bought 1,700 shares.
One purchase.
Yep. Compared to that one solitary purchase, company insiders executed $99.3 million in aggregate sales.
The selling is entirely one directional. It is a mass liquidation by the people closest to the data.
And it gets so much worse when you look at who is doing the selling. The executive chairman, David Fisher, who served as the CEO until early 2026, he sold $54.5 million of stock all by himself.
Just unbelievable timing, too.
Right. The report specifically highlights the timing. Fisher was selling massive discretionary blocks of stock at $231.50 just days before this July 2026 research report was published. He was dimping shares right at the absolute all-time highs.
If we connect this insider behavior to the broader picture evaluation, it makes total rational sense. The executives are acting like rational economic actors. Kimi's report points out that at $242 a share, Inova is trading at the 96.5th percentile of its own historical valuation range.
It is trading at 4.1 times its book value.
Let's put that in context. Their direct competitor, OneMain, trades at 7 to 8 times their actual earnings and maybe 2 times their book value.
Yeah.
Nova, meanwhile, is trading at 14 to 15 times forward guided earnings, meaning earnings that haven't even happened yet, and over 4 times book value.
The executives are looking at a stock price that is historically exceptionally expensive.
Yes.
But think about the psychological disconnect here for you, the listener. If you are an executive who truly believes the corporate narrative, if you believe the Grasshopper Bank deal is a regulatory certainty that is going to add 25% to earnings,
right.
If you believe your SMB pivot has fundamentally changed the risk profile of the business forever, if you believe you're building an impenetrable moat, why are you liquidating nearly $100 million of your personal stock right before you cross the finish line to secure that bank charter?
That is the multi-million dollar question that should keep any Inova investor awake at night. Actions speak louder than press releases.
Always.
And the report notes another disturbing data point. The pace of the corporate buybacks, the ones supporting the stock price, actually decelerated sharply the first quarter of 2026, dropping to just $15.6 million.
Oh, wow. So they slowed down the corporate buying.
Yes. Management claimed this was simply to preserve cash to close the Grasshopper acquisition. But crucially, while the company stopped buying, the insiders did not pause their selling.
The report also flags a massive corporate governance issue regarding how these executives are paid. Inova's long-term executive compensation structure has zero performance conditions attached to it.
That is a critical flaw. In a well-governed company, executives get stock options that only vest if they hit certain targets, like maintaining a 20% return on equity or keeping the loan default rate below 5%. it aligns their pay with the long-term health of the business.
But Enova stock options are granted quarterly and function essentially just like basic appreciation rights. Regardless of whether the company hits its credit quality hurdles, regardless of whether the loans they issue today blow up 3 years from now, the executives get the stock.
They are heavily structurally incentivized to pump the stock price up in the short term, execute the SMB pivot narrative, and monetize their shares immediately before the credit cycle turns.
It's essentially a risk-free ATM for management.
It really is.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground. We have laid out the bull case, the incredible execution of the SMB pivot, the potential of the bank charter creating a permanent cost moat, and the fast-turning nature of their loan book. Mm. And we have laid out a terrifying bear case, the $774 million accounting mirage, the regulatory cliffhanger hanging over the Grasshopper deal, the true lender risks, and the fact that insiders are heading for the exits at record highs. For you, the listener, sitting at home trying to figure out how this story ends, how do you read the future? You don't have to guess. The report lays out exact falsification tests.
A falsification test is a fundamental metric that will definitively prove either the bull narrative or the bear narrative wrong in real time. It removes the emotion and forces you to look at the raw data as it comes in.
And the most immediate event to test these theories was the Q2 earnings print scheduled for July 23, 2026. Let's detail the parameters. If the bull case is right, the report calculates that a justified fundamental value for this stock is between $180 and $260 a share. What specifically needs to happen for that scenario to play out?
For the bull case to hold, three major things must happen flawlessly. First, that SMB default rate, the absolute engine of their entire pivot strategy, must hold steady at its historical 4.6% plateau. Even as the newer, rapidly growing loans begin to age and season, that default rate cannot crack.
Okay, what's second?
Second, the Grasshopper Bank acquisition must secure clean, unencumbered approval from the OCC and the Federal Reserve by the second half of 2026, without regulators attaching crippling capital restrictions.
And third?
Their wholesale funding costs need to keep falling.
And if the bear case is right, the report assigns a brutal justified value of just $70 to $117 a share. That implies a drop of more than 50% from the current price. What triggers that avalanche?
The bear case completely hinges on the turn of the broader credit cycle. Right now, across the wider lending industry, deep subprime stress is highly elevated. If you look at subprime auto loans, defaults are sitting at 32-year highs.
Wow, 32-year highs.
Yeah. Enova's customers are currently sitting just one tier above that distress. The bear case triggers if that macro stress creeps up the credit spectrum into Enova's customer base. The specific metric to watch is the SMB 30-plus day delinquency rate.
Delinquency meaning borrowers who are late but haven't completely defaulted yet. It's the early warning system.
Exactly. And the report notes that this metric already ticked up ominously from 6.2% to 7.1% in the first quarter of 2026. If that delinquency rate balloons further, the 4.6% default plateau is finished.
The models will have to be marked down, the $774 million premium will evaporate, and the earnings will collapse.
Add in a regulatory delay or a block of the Grasshopper deal by the Fed, and the entire high-growth narrative completely implodes.
So the market has already paid for a perfect, flawless future at $232 a share. If Enova hits a single pothole, a single bad quarter for SMB loans where defaults spike to 6%, or a frown from the OCC granting the advocacy groups a public hearing, does the stock just fall off a cliff?
The asymmetry in this investment is severe. There is virtually no margin of safety at these prices for the ordinary, inevitable accidents of consumer credit. The market is pricing in absolute flawless execution for years to come.
Which is a very dangerous game to play.
And here is a highly counterintuitive point that Kimi brings up regarding the bank charter itself. Even if Enova does win the regulatory battle and gets the bank, it might actually hurt the stock price in the long run.
Hey, how is that possible? We just spent 10 minutes talking about how the bank charter lowers their cost of funds and boosts earnings by 25%. How does that hurt the stock?
Because of how the market values banks versus fintechs. Kimi points to precedents like Synchrony Financial. Synchrony has a massive deposit-funded lending model. They're incredibly profitable. But because they are a deposit-funded bank, they are heavily regulated by the Fed, they face strict capital requirements, and they are viewed by Wall Street as a slow-growth utility. As a result, Synchrony trades at a much lower valuation multiple.
Oh, I see.
If Enova successfully becomes a bank, their earnings might go up. But Wall Street might decide to stop valuing them at 15 times earnings, like a tech startup, and start valuing them at 8x earnings like a boring bank.
So they win the battle for the charter, but completely lose the war on their valuation multiple. Their earnings go up 25%, but their valuation multiple gets cut in half. The stock crashes anyway. Incredible.
It's a real catch-22.
Let's recap the insane journey we took today. We witnessed the anatomy of a brilliant 9x stock run fueled by management's masterclass execution of pivoting away from 147% consumer loans into the much cleaner short-duration SMB space.
We explored the high stakes, bet the company regulatory gamble to buy Grasshopper Bank, defeat the true lender legal risks, and finally build a true cost moat.
We stared into the terrifying abyss of a $774 million fair value accounting premium that could vanish in a mild recession. And we saw the glaring, deeply uncomfortable divergence between a corporation publicly buying its own stock while its executives quietly dump nearly $100 million of their own shares.
It is the ultimate picture of a company operating at the absolute peak of its powers, but priced at a level that brutally demands those powers never, ever wane.
Exactly. At $232 a share, Enova is priced for absolute, unblinking perfection. But before we wrap up this deep dive, we want to leave you with one final, provocative thought to mull over, something that goes completely beyond the balance sheet and the regulators.
This is where the long-term story gets really interesting.
The research report mentions the looming multi-year threat of embedded finance competitors. We are talking about massive tech companies like Block with their Square loans, PayPal Working Capital, and American Express.
The tech platforms that already own the financial plumbing?
Right. Think about Enova's true edge, spending 22% of their revenue on marketing and using 95 terabytes of behavioral data to underwrite strangers faster than anyone else. But what happens in 3 to 5 years when the platforms that already process a small business's daily credit card transactions decide to just offer the loans themselves directly inside the merchant app?
Block and PayPal already see every single dollar of cash flow that a small business generates in real time. They don't need to guess about risk, and they don't need to spend 22% of their revenue on Google Ads to find the customer.
If customer acquisition costs go to absolute zero for the big tech platforms because the borrower is already captured in their ecosystem, does the pure execution edge of a legacy online lender like Enova simply cease to exist?
It is the ultimate existential threat. When the toll booth to reach the customer completely disappears, the fastest runner on the treadmill might just find out they've been running in the wrong direction all along.
Which brings us right back to the beginning. When you look at Enova today, you might see the brilliant, flawless execution of an SMB pivot and a pending bank charter. But if you look closer through the lens of level 3 accounting, massive insider selling, and the looming threat of embedded finance, that picture starts to look terrifyingly fragile. Keep your eyes open.